This is Dee Blick. Welcome to Lead Well, Live Well for UK Health Radio. Hello and welcome to Lead Well, Live Well with me, Dee Blick, for UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio station. Oh, thank you for joining us. It's lovely to have your company today. Now, in the studio today, I have a woman who is as intriguing as she is talented and just plain lovely. She's written a number one best-selling book, Humanity 2.0, Redefining Humanity in the Age of Artificial Intelligence, so it's highly topical. She's also a globally recognised copywriter with a fascinating backstory, and we're going to be delving into that as we move through the show. I'm talking about Kazi Quinton. A warm welcome to the show, Kazi.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Dee. Pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's lovely to have you, darling. So let's start with your fascinating career in the police long before you became a copywriter and a best-selling author.
Well, thank you. Well, before writing, actually, I travelled quite a bit. I travelled to LA, lived in New York, Hawaii for a while, all over the UK. And then actually I realised I needed a proper career and I wanted to do something a lot more meaningful. But I was always torn between medicine and law, and I was drawn to either one or the other, but I didn't know which one. I couldn't decide. And it was actually a paramedic who suggested that I become a coroner's officer because that role sits at the intersection of both medicine and law. But those roles very rarely ever come up. Luckily for me, one came up and I was lucky enough to get the position. And at the time, I became the first female civilian coroner's officer in that particular police force. And I have to say that professionally, I loved my job very much indeed. Although every case involved a death or several deaths, I always saw the role as an honour. I was meeting people at the worst moments of their lives. And it was often on the worst day they would ever experience. My job was to establish exactly what had happened. But just as importantly, I was there to support these families by helping them understand the medical and the legal processes they were suddenly facing. I couldn't take away their pain, but I could offer clarity. I could show these families, these people, compassion, and I could be a steady presence when everything felt overwhelming and everything in their world at that moment in time would clearly be falling apart. So I enjoyed that role very much. And from the coroner's office, I joined a major investigation team. We refer to them in the UK as MIT. And I also actually, due to my role on MIT, I spent time attaching to the medical examiner's office in Washington. And that was a very fascinating experience for me. They are death scene investigators, which would be the equivalent to, in the UK, what we call coroner's officers, actually have far more medical training than we do in the UK. And seeing live cases unfold showed me just how differently deaths can be investigated across countries. I have investigated myself plane crashes, train crashes, many car crashes, sadly, deaths of British citizens abroad killed by tragic accidents or animals, and many other tragic and complex ways that we may meet our end, even war-related death. But I have to say I've never been exposed to so much death by gun crime to what I observed in the UK. Working in MIT meant investigating the most serious of crimes, actually, and predominantly these were murder cases I investigated. So the stakes, as you can imagine, were very high. And that's where my natural curiosity really became an asset. Good investigations, I learned, are all about listening carefully, about asking better questions, and noticing what other people might miss and patiently putting all the pieces together. And here in the UK, the clearer and stronger our criminal cases are, the better chance of justice and ultimately of keeping our people safe and by getting the bad guys off the streets.
Goodness me, that is astonishing. I've heard your story before when we've been chatting anecdotally. I think what an accomplishment to be the first female civilian. But I would imagine also, you've got to be really good at compartmentalising what you've seen during the day with then going about your everyday life, because it could have such a profound impact on you. And I'm thinking about is there a connection, because your career was incredible in the police, first female civilian. What actually drew you to copywriting? Because it's quite a marked difference, isn't it, to go from that then into becoming, well, a globally acclaimed copywriter. So what drew you to copywriting initially?
It's a great question, actually. It's one I get asked a lot, actually. And I think curiosity has always been a driving force for me. I like understanding the world around me. And when I do something, I want to do it properly to the best of my ability. And in policing, that meant paying close attention to the details and carrying out research, deep research into any investigation I was working on. A big part of that role actually was writing. I had to take complex evidence and explain it clearly so that lawyers, judges, juries and families could all understand what had happened. Accuracy did really matter, but also so did clarity. If something was confusing or poorly written, then the truth could get lost. Over time, I realised that those case files were actually essentially stories. Factual evidence-based stories, but nonetheless they were stories. And that really is exactly what copywriting is. You're still telling the truth, but just in a different kind of a context. And of course there's no marketing or sales in criminal investigations, but the skills are actually surprisingly similar. I found you are building a clear, compelling narrative that does lead to somebody somewhere making a decision. In copywriting, that decision might be to subscribe to someone's email list or to purchase a product or a service or engage in some way. And in policing, it was about exposing the truth so that the right decision could be made. What drew me to copywriting actually was my love of writing and of storytelling. And interestingly, now I specialize in writing case stories or case studies, as some people refer to them. I now interview clients instead of witnesses, but the goal actually is exactly the same. I want to understand what really happened, why it happened, and then I want to explain it clearly and honestly so that others can learn from it.
It's just fantastic. And you had me hooked when you talked about natural curiosity, because I truly believe that for any good writer, and I hope I can include myself in that category, but for any good writer, curiosity is fundamental, because curiosity means that we really go under the radar. We ask the questions that others don't. We're pulling together this compelling story. And it really interested me, you saying that, because I was interviewed recently for a magazine, and I was asked what was the big contributor to my success. And I said, my innate curiosity, that I don't just like going for top level stuff. I don't just want the cherry on the cake and the icing. I want the whole cake itself. And if that means that I have to dig and dig and keep on digging, then I will do it. And I think you're so right about curiosity being a cornerstone to being a great writer, because also it enables us to present this beautifully rounded picture, to ask the questions that others don't. And I know that you've made your name writing fantastic case studies, and I just think it's pretty special that you've brought all this experience from working in the police and channeled every bit of it into being a brilliant writer and then focusing on case studies. And so what I'd like to do now, before we come to the break, is just really ask you, you know, you've got this thriving copywriting business, and I know you are a much loved writer and person. When I look at LinkedIn and I see the people that are around you, they're all rooting for you. They love you. They love your work. And it's just great for me as well as a writer to see a truly fantastic writer getting that recognition. But I'd like to just ask you now, how have you built your business and what have been the biggest challenges that you face or you continue to face? We've got a couple of minutes before the break and I'd love your answers on that.
Biggest challenges. Well, first of all, thank you very much indeed, Dee, for what you said. Very kind. Biggest challenges, I suppose there would be probably four. Let's see if I can get through them before the break. I think building my business has actually been very rewarding, as you say, but I would also describe it as very stretching. I think one of the biggest adjustments was moving from a salaried role where you get paid every month and you don't need to worry about where that income is coming from. And then you suddenly realize you have to market yourself and you have to go find the work. I mean, I love what I do, but like many business owners, I'm far more comfortable promoting my clients than promoting myself, as you would know. I am open, engaged, and I'm genuinely interested in people, but I'm not particularly good at blowing my own trumpet. And that said, I have been very fortunate much of my work has come through recommendations. When my clients like what I've written for them, they recommend me to other business colleagues and associates. And actually, that's where an awful lot of my work has actually come from. Another ongoing challenge for me is time. I'm naturally drawn to supporting my clients, shaping their brand messaging and being their biggest cheerleader and helping them reach the right audiences for them. But running my own business also means that I need to balance stepping back from my client work and investing time in my own visibility, networking, and in my own growth. That's something I still have to be quite intentional about. And for me, that is a continual work in progress. And finally, learning when to say no and when to charge properly. That's another lesson for me. I care deeply about the work I take on and I give a lot to every project. That is a strength, but it also means knowing when a piece of work has grown beyond its original scope and it needs to be treated as such. Finding that balance is also another lesson for me.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And I think I know, because I've worked with so many talented writers over the years and I've worked with loads of brilliant authors. And the one hill that they die on is being able to promote themselves in such a way that their talent is fully recognised and rewarded. And I count myself fortunate that I am a writer who became a marketer. So I know all the tips and the tricks and the tools to actually promote your business. But I also understand that when I listen to you and I've looked at you and thinking, blimey, you're such a talented person. And I can see how talent is absolutely fundamental, and sometimes we need to give that extra bit, and the extra bit is having the confidence to go out in that world, to wave that flag and say, hey, I'm here, I've done something quite magnificent, have a look at this latest case study, take a look at my book. And it doesn't come naturally to those of us that are not marketers or natural self-promoters. That's why I think it's so important that we surround ourselves with people that can be our cheerleaders and also that can encourage us to cheerlead ourselves. And I see that in you, you know, the time that I've got to know you, that your talent. And actually, I know I commented recently on a brilliant piece of work you'd written, and I was like, where are you in this, Kazi? Because up front, you should be promoting yourself with all those calls to action. So we're coming to the first break, but don't go anywhere, because after the break I'm going to be talking to Kazi about her brilliant book.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
welcome back to today's show. And I'm with the fabulous Kazi Quinton talking about her career, her incredible career. And also now we're going to pivot and talk about that book. Kazi, tell me about your book, because it's absolutely fascinating. It's hugely topical. It became a number one bestseller. And I would love you to paint a picture of your book for our listeners.
Thank you, dear. Thank you very much. Well, Humanity 2.0 is not a technical book about AI, as many people think, really. It's more a book about people. I mean, I wrote it for anyone who feels curious, uncertain, or reflective about the world we're now moving into. I mean, AI is advancing rapidly, and a lot of the conversation around it, I think, often can feel overwhelming, polarizing, and definitely over-technical. I wanted to step back and ask a question. And that question was, what does it mean to be human in the middle of all of this seismic technical change? And what is the difference between human intelligence and artificial intelligence? And in order to answer this question, basically what defines being human, I went back over 170 years and I started reading Darwin's theory on evolution. I studied philosophers, psychologists, linguists, humanists, and software engineers as well, actually. And what I discovered, I have to say, was absolutely fascinating. I learned a great deal about many studies that had been done over many years, all with the aim of answering this fundamental question. And I also wanted to know who coined that term, artificial intelligence, and when that came to be. The date and who coined that phrase and why is in my book. I also wanted to study about the first time artificial intelligence was used in the world and how and where, and what systems in what fields and where AI has been used for years already prior to this period of time now. So I decided to split the book in two. The first half of my book talks about what it means to be human, about human intelligence, what being human truly means. And the second half of the book looks at artificial intelligence. For part of the AI section, I actually ended up speaking to a group of six AIs. Now, at the time, AIs weren't as sophisticated as they are now. The book was released early last year, and I'd been working on it the previous year. So the AI advancements weren't as they are today. And I decided to ask these AIs questions, bizarre questions I started with, ranging from, have you ever tasted snow? To, are you a threat to the human race? I dug deep into their data sets and I really asked some very telling questions. I didn't edit any of their answers. What is in the book is exactly what I asked each of them. And I watched them become more sophisticated over the weeks and months that I were working with all six of these AIs. So before your listeners think this might be too technical, actually, I must say, my North Star for the book was taking all of this information and writing it in a way that anyone of any age could understand, and particularly a non-technical person. I mean, readers often say it's quite an easy book to read and a little thought-provoking rather than intimidating. Many have also commented positively on the image of the front cover. And that's because I wanted to visualize the book being about the relationship between humans and technology and not necessarily a battle between us. At its heart, I think the book explores curiosity, adaptability, ethics, and responsibility. It looks at how we can use AI thoughtfully without losing the qualities that makes us human, such as empathy, judgment, creativity, language, and connection. The feedback that has meant the most to me is when readers say the book helped them think differently or feel more informed about the future. I think it's about inviting people into a conversation about how we choose to move forward.
That is amazing. I mean, I know I started writing it. How now, nicking your book. That's a bit of a fall over words. I started reading it one night and I think I read it over three nights. And I just found it absolutely fascinating that you were taking me on this journey into AI and you were asking the most brilliant questions. And I know it's a huge undertaking for any author, any writer. Like, I understand as a writer myself how we're naturally drawn to writing a book, but it's a pretty big undertaking writing a book. And I just wondered, question, did you ever get writer's block? You know, how was it different writing this book from, say, writing copy?
It's a great question, actually. I think writing copy is about clarity, focus, and also momentum, because when you write copy, you're guiding someone towards a decision. So every word has to earn its place on the page. It's writing concisely and with intention. I think writing a book is different because it requires patience and also skills to keep the attention of the reader for longer. So I don't think you're leading the reader to an action so much as inviting them into a longer conversation when you write a book. You can actually explore ideas, you can sit with uncertainty, and you can also allow space for reflection, to breathe, to pause, as you would know being a great writer yourself. I think structurally writing a book is more demanding. I'd say copywriting is about precision, and I'd say book writing is more about depth, really. I think right when you ask about writer's block, actually... make me smile. No, I didn't actually get writer's block. The opposite, actually. My biggest challenges were deciding what information to use to put in the book, what to leave out, and how to structure the book. I had a lot of academic information, many points of views of brilliant minds, and I wanted to share more experiments also, but I was always working towards simplicity and answering only two questions in the most easiest, simplest way I could. And that was, what is human intelligence and what is artificial intelligence? And define them both.
I love that. And I wanted to pick up on this point you made about writer's block, because I get asked this quite a bit, because I've written 6 books. And I am just like you. I am the opposite of writer's block. So I will get up on a morning, tumble out of bed, hoist myself onto the settee with laptop, and I can write for 10-hour stretches. And literally all I do is pop to the loo and get a pint of water, keep topping myself up with water. I look really grungy. I probably haven't brushed my hair. And so I definitely wouldn't want to be on a Zoom call where people could see me. But yeah, I don't get writer's block. And I think that's because fundamentally we just love writing, don't we? And that's where I sit. I always say that I am a writer who became a marketer. So I love that you don't get writer's block. I also like the fact that you were talking about that focus on simplicity. And there's that ubiquitous phrase, if you cannot explain it simply, then you don't understand it well enough. I'm sure it's certainly a phrase that I have used in the past, that it's almost like our challenge and our modus operandi as writers is to make things simple so that people can understand it. It becomes relatable. It doesn't become a chore to read. It becomes wonderful to read. And certainly I really felt that with your book, that it was an actual delight to read. And right, I'm just aware that we are now coming up to the second break. And after the break, I'm going to be talking to Kasi about AI, and whether she thinks it's raising or lowering the overall quality of content. Is it making copywriters redundant? And then, of course, Kasi will be asking me the question that I haven't got a clue what she's going to ask me. So don't go away.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movements and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to Lead Well, Live Well with me, Dee Blick, and the fabulous Cassie Quinton. And Cassie, I really now want to talk about AI, because undoubtedly for writers, I know that some writers are threatened by AI, some writers are overusing it, and in my opinion, they're bleaching out the brand that they represent. And I think it's really pitting writers on one side and people on the other that think, oh, you know what? I don't need a writer. I'm just going to use AI to formulate my voice. I just wondered, what's your opinion on AI? And has it changed your approach to research and then to writing copy?
Oh, okay. Yes, it has, the short answer to the question. And I really like that phrase, Dee, bleaching out the brand, because that's exactly the risk, isn't it? When you outsource too much to AI, your work can start to sound a little like everyone else's. I'm not anti-AI at all. In fact, of course, I use it, but I'm very deliberate about where it sits in the process. I'm actually currently working with a terrific copywriter and an AI strategist in Canada, a gentleman by the name of Nick Esborn, who teaches businesses how to avoid what you refer to as bleaching out, and he refers to as brand drift. I mean, brand drift is a real issue I see right now, because AI tends to steer people towards the middle. It's trained on patterns and averages. So if you rely on it for your voice, you run the risk of losing the very thing that makes your brand recognizable. I mean, there's another layer too. A lot of people use the same prompt libraries, asking the same tools exactly the same questions. So, of course, the output becomes a bit samey. I mean, and that's where the bleaching out or brand drift then happens. And it's not just bland writing you're then having. What you have is sameness at scale, really. So how has it changed my approach? Well, research and analysis, actually, I use it for, and I think it's brilliant for that. I think only yesterday I used it to create a sentiment analysis on a big set of customer feedback for a company I'm working with. And it pulled out patterns, and importantly for me, the exact language that customers were using. And it saved me hours and hours of work that I would have had to have done myself. And for me, that kind of work improves my accuracy and also my speed. So that's a benefit, I think. For writing, I use it as an assistant, not as the voice. So I might use it to spot repetition in my draft writing, grammar errors, for example, or to help me with ideation for a project aspect once I've set the strategy. But the strategic thinking, the positioning, the nuance and the implications, that all sits with me as the writer. And this is because AI can generate words, yes, but it doesn't carry responsibility. AI doesn't understand consequences, and it can also still get things wrong. Hallucinations is the term used to describe that. So for me, the sweet spot is, yes, use AI to support the process, but the person, the human being, should be there to protect the brand.
I'm with you all the way there. I was kind of like mini fist pumping you that for me, as a writer, I use AI for research and for analysis. It's fantastic. And sometimes if I'm interviewing somebody, I will list all the questions and I'll pop onto AI to see if I've missed a great question that AI can proffer forward. And often I'll stick with the questions that I had. But what I'm seeing as a marketer, and a friend of mine who's a commissioning editor, she attended an event a few weeks ago, and two of the marketers there that were responsible for writing company blogs said, oh, we're using AI to write the blogs. And I thought, well, where's your brand story in this? Where's your brand DNA? And almost taking this to its logical conclusion, I was chatting to the editor of a magazine that I write for, and he was telling me that In the space of a week, he received two virtually identical press releases from two businesses that were very different, but they had, you know, complementary products and services. And I think a lot of editors are becoming very wary of the sheer volume of AI. I actually work with several contributors for a magazine. I'm the commissioning editor. And the one thing that I've said to all my contributors is, by all means, use AI to support your research, but I am looking for your authentic voice. I'm looking that when I see your article, I know immediately that it's been written by you, that it's been crafted by you. And of course, we use edit. You know, we want to make sure that we've got the punctuation right, that we're not being overly laborious on a sentence. But I am almost seeing this tipping point where, particularly in the small business community that I have served for years, that there are two camps. There's the absolute, I will not be using AI for my writing. Then there's the, I absolutely will be using AI for my writing. And I think it's got to be in the middle. And obviously, I've written a book about branding and about the importance of a magnetic and authentic personal brand. And magnetism and authenticity is not predicated on having an AI voice. So I think it's important, isn't it, for you and I as writers that we fly the flag for AI in all its positive dimensions, but we're also brave enough to stand proud and say, actually, it shouldn't take the place of your brand. And I like that phrase, brand drift, or manage, you know, it's really hard to say it, the bleaching of the brand. The other day I actually said the bleaching of the blounds, and I thought, oh my word, where am I going with this? But I want to ask you, before I talk about what the future holds for you, and of course you tell me your question for me, is what are the glaring areas that you see? You're an experienced, you're a very successful copywriter. You represent brands all over the world. And probably like me, you also look at copy and you're like, oh my word, your head is in your hands at the howler that you see. What are the glaring errors that you see as an experienced and successful copywriter?
Okay, well, there's a few actually. I tend to see some falling in the patterns. I think one of the first that I'd suggest is mistaking fluency for meaning. Because something actually might read really well, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's new information or it's useful information. I think AI can sound confident while also being a little vague. And I think that can be dangerous for your credibility as a business. And I think outsourcing the thinking, the strategy, positioning and judgment I'm seeing is sometimes being handed over to these tools. And these tools don't understand context, risk or consequences. So I think that's something to watch out for. I mean, AI also doesn't know what shouldn't be said. And I think the third point I would say is brand dilution, a very important one that we touched on today. When AI becomes the primary writer rather than your assistant, your tone and your personality will drift. Over time, brands lose their distinction and audiences will feel it when this happens. I mean, even if your audience can't quite put a name to what's happening, they will actually feel it. And I think finally, unchecked errors. Hallucinations, outdated facts, or just subtle inaccuracies that can sometimes slip through when people are trusting the output maybe a little too much. I mean, AI should always be reviewed, I feel, by someone who understands the subject matter and who knows the audience of that readership. I think overall AI can be a powerful amplifier, but I think it should amplify whatever is already there. If there's strong thinking, leadership thinking, and also human insight behind the work, I think the quality should go up. And if not, I think all that will happen is that you will get more content and faster.
Oh, do you know, I love that. And I was thinking we almost need to make this a copywriting masterclass. But the bit I took from the very beginning there, it was almost you were saying, don't fall into style over substance. That most definitely useful information, because as writers, if we're representing businesses small and large, then it's absolutely imperative that the story that we tell is predicated on useful information, not on fancy highfalutin stuff that's been fueled by the fodder of AI. I really love that. It really resonated with me. What I also love is the fact that you've actually written a book about AI, but you have a very healthy relationship with AI. You're able to be super objective and clear and say these are the benefits of AI when you're writing, whether you're a writer or whether you're a business that's writing. These are the many benefits, but don't fall into the trap of using it to substitute your voice. And I think it makes you so credible, particularly with this number one best-selling book behind you. And I just wanted to chat now about, what does the future hold for you, Kazi? Where are you going? What are you writing? Are there more books, more case studies? Tell me what's happening.
Well, great question. Thank you very much, Dee. I mean, I have to say, I genuinely love what I do. I tend to get completely lost in my writing. And there's something very special about helping a business express itself in a way that people connect with, and some on a very deep level as well. I absolutely love supporting, launching, and helping businesses grow. And there's something very beautiful about knowing your main tool is your ability to write and to understand people. I mean, there is actually a criminal lawyer I greatly admire. His name is Jerry Spence. I mean, he was actually a chap recommended to me by the very skilled copywriter David Deutsch, often called the $1 billion copywriting because of the value of the work that's been created by David, and a terrific copywriter. Incidentally, it was David who came up with the title for my book, Humanity 2.0. I'd written many title options, and I was having a conversation with him one day, and literally he offered one, and I instantly knew it was right, so I went with it. So I have to thank David for that. Going back to Jerry Spence, who never lost a criminal case as a criminal lawyer in America, he once said, and this really resonated with me, words are powerful. They can kill and they can heal. And I believe that deeply. And that is why my focus now is on becoming the best copywriter, case story and brand specialist I can be. I want to be known as reliable and as an effective writer. I mean, someone companies can trust with their voice, their meaning and their reputation. I would also love to teach companies how to think about writing, not just produce more of it. How to protect their voice in a fast-moving world, how to use tools like AI intelligently, and how to ask better questions about who they are really speaking to and what they want their people to feel. Whether I think I'm writing, teaching, speaking, or supporting a business behind the scenes, for me, the goal is the same: to use our words carefully, responsibly, and with intent, and also to help others do the same.
Gosh, I love that. And very, very quickly, because I'm just aware that we're coming towards the end of our interview, will there be another book?
Someone else has asked me that question recently, actually. I love writing, and that book was a very exciting journey for me, very exciting indeed. So maybe, who knows, maybe.
Who knows? Right, well, it's time for you now. It's been a wonderful interview, really fascinating. You're a fascinating woman, and it's now time for me to flip the tables, and you've got a question to ask me, and I haven't got a clue what it is.
Yes, I'm very excited about this, actually. There were so many questions I could ask you that I would like to ask you, but I decided upon this one, and that is this. After 40 years of watching marketing evolve from billboards to AI generated content, what's the one marketing principle that's remained surprisingly constant?
Gosh, I love that. And it's something that's top of mind. The fundamental thing is never to forget that we're hoping to persuade people with compelling narrative to either buy from us, to advocate us, to recommend us. So I would say that the target audiences, those people, are always the same. Unless we're selling to bots, we're bot to bot. Nothing has changed in that area. And I always say that the symbols on the map may have changed, but the map itself hasn't. But fundamentally, I think it was Peter Doyle who said, Marketing is a philosophy of business that places the customer at the center of the universe. And that is as true now as it was when David Ogilvy, you know, really illuminated us with all his fabulous insights and campaigns decades ago. That will never change. So I don't know if that was what you were hoping for, but that's my sort of top of head response.
I think that's a great answer, and it's a timely reminder that when maybe we're feeling a little overwhelmed, when there's so much information, just to remember actually the basic structure that is what we do. That is what businesses should remember. Great answer, Dee.
Thank you. Well, Kazi, it's been wonderful to have you on the show today. I'm sure you'll be back in the future because you've got so many, you know, genuinely interesting things to share that are helpful and inspiring and illuminating, and all the wonderful words that I can pluck out of my little thesaurus for you. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, everybody, I really hope you enjoyed that interview with Kazi, and I just want to leave you with a few thoughts of my own. I want to talk a little bit about authenticity because so much of my work takes me into organisations where I'm the mentor to the business owner, and understandably, they want to build their personal brand alongside their business brand. And one of the first things that we talk about is the importance of being authentic. Now, I know this might sound mad, but what I'm seeing is a race to the bottom where business leaders are in danger of sacrificing their authentic voice at the altar of AI using AI-generated content, as I discussed just now with Kazi. So I want to share a snippet from my latest book, You're the Best, from Chapter 4, Being Authentic is the Ace Up Your Sleeve. And I hope you identify with what I'm sharing here. Okay, here we go. It's time to be unapologetically you, human and relatable. Being original wins trust. Authentic people know what they stand for. They don't need everyone to like them. They place value over validation and are open to learning and to sharing. I would imagine you have significant untapped potential. So give yourself time and space to evolve. But don't lose sight of your bigger vision that you want to be authentic and magnetic. And please accept that your common sense is anything but common. Something that holds many of us back when building our personal brand and seeing ourselves influential is the tendency to downplay their knowledge as mere common sense. Are you guilty of this? I was. I still am at times. Accept that your common sense is the result of many years of dedication and hard work. It's anything but common to those keen to learn from you and be associated with you. So I really hope you'll take that from today's show, that you are more than good enough, and maybe accepting that this is a long overdue acknowledgement, because self-belief really can unlock your potential. And that's my parting words for today's show, and I look forward to sharing more with you in the future. You've been listening to Lead Well, Live Well on UK Health Radio.